This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. On Saturday, an assailant opened fire at a Dollar General store in Jacksonville, Florida, shooting and killing three black customers before taking his own life. The perpetrator was a white male in his 20s who came to the scene wearing tactical gear and carrying an AR-15-style rifle and a handgun. Authorities say he left behind documents detailing the racist motivation for the killings. Here's Jacksonville Sheriff T.K. Waters speaking at a press conference.
The Clay County Sheriff's Office, who has been assisting our agency with this investigation, received information after the shooting that the shooter had authored several manifestos, one to his parents, one to the media, and one to federal agents. Portions of these manifestos detailed the shooter's disgusting ideology of hate. Plainly put, this shooting was racially motivated, and he hated black people. I want to be very clear that there is absolutely no evidence that the shooter is part of any large group. We know that he acted completely alone. This is a dark day in Jacksonville's history. Any loss of life is tragic, but the hate that motivated the shooter's killing spree adds an additional layer of heartbreak. There's no place for hate in our community, and this is not Jacksonville.
The authorities say the gunman acted alone. The shooting is part of a broader movement of extremist violence that's taken hold around the country and the world over the last decade. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did you feel when you heard the news out of Jacksonville this weekend? What kind of action would you like to see the government take when it comes to hate crimes and extremist acts of violence? Do you have questions about extremist movements in the United States? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Heidi Byrick is the co-founder and chief strategy officer of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. Heidi, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We heard Sheriff Waters there making a point saying that the Jacksonville shooter acted alone, which is technically true. But as someone who studies the white supremacist movement, how people influence each other online, what is your reaction to that?
Well, it's clear he took the act on his own. What we don't know, but can probably speculate, is that he was reading, you know, racist material, hateful material, which is all over the web and which has inspired so many mass killings recently. People will remember the shooting at a grocery store in Buffalo last year, but also there was the recent incident where a man murdered a woman who put a pride flag in front of her shop in California, and he had a bunch of hateful material on his Twitter feed. This is probably the process that happened here, that somebody was radicalized into hate and then decided to do this. I think it's also interesting that in this case in Jacksonville, the assailant was wearing a Rhodesia patch, referring to the white-run government in Africa during colonial times, the same patch that Dylan Roof, the shooter in Charleston in 2015, was wearing. So he was clearly aware of the currents in the white supremacist world.
I've seen some analysts point toward that, like there's a performative nature here where people have seen other people write manifestos and they do it, in this case, want to make sure that other people see it. The act of violence is part of it, but it seems like this performance of getting the public's attention is part of the goal here.
Yeah, that is definitely the case. Manifestos play on each other, and each new shooter with their manifesto builds on the last one. That happened with the Buffalo shooter, whose manifesto was very similar to the man who killed more than 50 people in mosques in New Zealand a few years ago. Frankly, I'm glad that this manifesto never made its way onto the internet and therefore wasn't seen by other people who might be radicalized or want to one-up this shooting. These manifestos are extremely dangerous.
Your organization, the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, put out a statement about the shooting saying, quote, "We demand that politicians and tech companies take action now." Now, you just mentioned the manifesto is not going online. What would you like to see from social media companies, search providers, and others that might help stop the flow of this kind of the kind of inspiration that might lead someone to an act like this?
Yeah, there is a lot that still needs to be done on online systems. You know, Facebook probably has the best policies that they're enforcing right now in terms of the mainstream platforms, but you still find hate and extremism on there that isn't caught by their AI systems. Twitter, or X now, unfortunately, seems to have completely given up with content moderation And there's all kinds of hate and extremism on the site, from neo-Nazi material to misogynistic material. These things should not be on these platforms. But we also face something else, which there are large sections of the web that are completely unregulated now, places like Telegram or 4chan, where you can't stop this extremism from spreading and indoctrinating others. And that's a very unfortunate aspect of where we are right now.
Talking to Heidi Byrick with the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism about this weekend's shooting targeting Black people in Jacksonville, Florida, and wider concerns about extremist violence, racist violence. You can join in with your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Rod is with us in La Crosse. Rod, hello.
Hello. Army discharged USMC in 77. Now, what really bothers me is that security guard at that college, I don't see why he didn't sit there and jump in a vehicle and follow him, seeing he knows that he put on a flak jacket, put on a mask. That just kind of amazes me that, I mean, I'm a Marine. I would have followed him, no doubt about it. No matter what they said, I had to stay there. But I would have followed him because I knew he was up to no good.
Rod, thanks for the call. Rod, referring to the security guard at a local Black college who had turned away the perpetrator. Are there things, this is at a much more up-close level, Heidi, are there things in the old, if you see something, say something vein that could also help prevent acts like this?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I don't want to second guess what happened here, but I do know that the college security folks did notify authorities after the incident. Perhaps that wasn't enough, but, you know, we can't blame them when somebody decides to do something like this. But you do... It is very important that if you see something weird that you let people know, because perhaps you can intervene. And actually the security, we don't know yet, but maybe ended up protecting the students on the college, but unfortunately not the folks who were shot at the Dollar General.
Thanks for the call, Rod, at 800-642-1234. A high profile event, excuse me, like this gets our attention now. Do we see trends over time, Heidi? Do we see the problem with particular kinds of extremist violence getting worse over the years?
Yes. In the last 5 to 7 years, there is no question that white supremacist domestic terrorism has been growing and is the number one domestic terrorism threat in this country. And that's not me saying that. The FBI has said that. The DHS has said that. The National Counterterrorism Center has said that. The federal government understands that this is the biggest threat. And of course, it's very different than, say, 20 years ago when Islamic extremism was the thing that we were focused on. So this is what the government needs to be working on and paying attention to. And as far as we can tell from testimony by the FBI director, they have put more resources towards this type of violence in recent years than they had, say, you know, 8-9 years ago.
We're talking to Heidi Byrick, co-founder and chief strategy officer of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, looking at the shooting targeting Black people in Jacksonville last week, wider concerns about extremist violence. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about that rise in white supremacist ideology and extremist violence in the U.S.? Do you have questions about how this works? Who is inspiring who? Join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered this kind of hateful stuff, maybe even inciting material, online? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Heidi Byrick from the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, looking at the racially motivated Jacksonville shooting over the weekend, how it connects to the broader extremist movement and racist violence elsewhere. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on how the media covers these kind of incidents? What do you think the government, if anything, should be doing to stop the tide of rising extremism? How about technology companies? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Hi. So I recently have come across something online which I found extremely disturbing. And I'm maybe looking for what is the right way to report something like this. I tried making a call to the FBI field office here in Wisconsin and was put on hold for 2 hours and eventually left a message. How do I actually get this information to the right person to maybe do a look at some of this?
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Chris, seeing what he saw as potentially dangerous postings on the internet, Heidi, is there a right way to draw someone's attention to that? If so, who?
Well, I hate to hear that you were put on hold for 2 hours. It seems unacceptable. That is exactly what you should do, which is alert the FBI. And I would also encourage people to report it to the tech companies. They're all of them, the mainstream ones at least, have reporting systems, and let them know that you've seen something problematic. But it is law enforcement that you're supposed to get in touch with. So your caller did the right thing.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Willem joins us now in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I've seen some sort of disturbing signs that I don't remember seeing in the past that have to do with politics. And like there's a neighbor or a non-neighbor's person in Colfax that has a sign that says lock and load, things are going to get nasty. And then claiming that, you know, the current president is a security threat to our nation and wake up America and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know. I think I know where that message is coming from. I find it disturbing that someone is suggesting that maybe there's going to be violence over.
Willem, thanks for the call. A lot of background noise in your call, but I think we get the gist. Heidi, Willem seeing what he sees as violent rhetoric now just on, you know, yard signs in his community.
Yeah, I mean, he is tapping into an increasing problem, which is rising political violence in this country. And if you look at polls, you find more and more people, this is particularly on the right end of the political spectrum, who are willing to use violence. And this kind of, you know, and we've had attacks, right? Nancy Pelosi's husband was attacked. Brett Kavanaugh had someone try to assault him in his home. Election officials in particular across this country have been seeing threats like they've never seen before. A lot of that driven by people who believe, you know, who are election deniers, who believe that Trump had his election stolen from him. This is a really serious situation, especially when you're talking about county and local folks who are just trying to do their jobs. And some of them have had to go into hiding at times, in particular two election workers here in Georgia that Trump targeted. So it's a bit scary and a very serious situation. And I sure hope the authorities are prepared for maybe some tumult around the 2024 elections.
Thanks for the call, Willem. Dick joins us now in Brooklyn, Wisconsin's Brooklyn. Dick, hello.
Hi. What I'd like to say is one of the things that concerns me is the fact that we have politicians who are exalting this type of behavior. And even though they might have conservative political views, there are other candidates who also have conservative political views who aren't backing that type of thing. Yet the right seems to be exalting those candidates that support this type of violence.
Dick, thanks for the call. Heidi, political leaders, political speakers, what would you hope to hear and see from them?
What I would really like to hear, especially from folks on the right, is denunciations absolutely clear about any kind of violent rhetoric. That would be so helpful to making things better in this country. You know, from my perspective, political leaders have a responsibility to be on the right side of things. And it would be really nice if we could see, say, for example, everybody who's running on the GOP ticket say, there will be no violence, there will be no violent rhetoric, we are not going to have this at the polls or in the election process. It would be a really wonderful thing to see. And it's a responsibility and one that they should bear.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Heidi Byrick with the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism about the weekend's shooting in Jacksonville. Other worries about extremist and racist violence. Heidi, I don't want to get through this conversation without talking about the factor of race. We heard the sheriff earlier being very explicit. The manifesto was unambiguous. This was a racist, a racially targeted shooting. How much do we worry about that as the center of motivation for extremist violence?
Well, it's a serious motivation, right? It's one of the oldest hateful motivations in the United States, going all the way back to when the Klan was formed after the Civil War and was the first domestic terrorist organization in the United States. We've had the shooting at the Buffalo supermarket, the Charleston church, and others. But I would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that pretty much all people of color and Jews have been targeted by this kind of violence, whether it's a synagogue in Pittsburgh or an El Paso Walmart. We have just had way too much domestic terrorism, and also at times targeting women specifically. There was a massacre of women by an extremely misogynistic guy in, I think, 2014 in Santa Barbara, California. We're just having domestic terrorism that's out of control, that's being driven by hate and bigotry.
Heidi, we've talked about technology companies, some about things that politicians can do. What other solutions are out there that would make you feel, you know, more hopeful that we could bring these trends down in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I can't understress the issue of the online space. I just don't believe that we would have the kind of problems that we're having today if this stuff wasn't proliferating out there. I mean, in the 1990s, how would you find this kind of hateful material? How would you find a Klan group? It's not in the phone book. So it's a seismic issue. But I think there are a lot of things that can happen. One is law enforcement stepping up and also being, you know, schooled on who these groups are, what they're up to, what they're doing, what they believe. That is one aspect of protecting the public. I also think that when communities stand up, as they have in Jacksonville in such horrendous circumstances, that it does have an effect on preaching love instead of preaching hate. So it's sort of a whole of society issue to beat back these terrible ideas and make it clear that they are unacceptable in polite society, in any society.
Heidi, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
I really appreciate you all having me on.
That's Heidi Byrick, co-founder and chief strategy officer of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. We've been talking about Saturday's shooting in Jacksonville, Florida, what it says about extremism and violence in the United States today. The number of elderly Americans behind bars has skyrocketed in recent decades, and costs are climbing for prisons as they deal with more advanced medical needs. As Sarah Lear reports, here in Wisconsin, that's led the Department of Corrections to open up a different kind of prison ward.
Oco Correctional is a minimum security facility surrounded by cornfields just outside Madison. Most of the inmates there sleep in bunk beds. But as nursing supervisor Rachel Snow explains, at a newly opened unit within Oak Hill, all the beds are low to the ground.
There's many of the guys that are down there that cannot navigate steps.
Wisconsin's Department of Corrections opened the assisted living facility earlier this year. On a recent summer day, the unit is busy with more than 20 inmates. Some use wheelchairs or walkers. Another does an exercise with a nurse intended to improve range of motion in his arm. Many of the men there need help with showering, dressing, or eating. And Snow says a lot of them have chronic conditions.
Respiratory issues, end-stage COPD, emphysema, cardiac issues.
There are more than 20,000 people locked up in Wisconsin prisons, and more than 15% are over age 55. That percentage has more than tripled over the last two decades.
As our incarcerated population ages, we will see a greater need.
The graying of Wisconsin's prison population mirrors national trends. Experts say that's partly because the country's population is getting older on average. But Mike Wessler, who advocates for reducing the incarcerated population through the Prison Policy Initiative, says it's also due to longer prison sentences.
In the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, there was a real focus on kind of tough on crime policies that ushered in an era of mass incarceration.
Harlan Richards was 30 when he was convicted of murder after stabbing someone in a fight. He served decades behind bars in Wisconsin before he was paroled at age 67. He says prison life is different for older inmates.
Yeah, I mean, you get aches and pains and you get medical problems, and a young guy can stand sleeping on a hard bed. He can stand, you know, the substandard food and stuff like that.
Increasingly, prison systems are responding to the needs of older inmates with specialized facilities. A federal prison in Massachusetts has a memory disorder unit to treat dementia. At a special needs prison in Nashville, inmates can be admitted to units with assisted living or nursing care. Bryce Peterson is a scientist with the CNA Center for Justice Research and Innovation. He says many people enter prison in worse health than the general public, in part because of poverty. Then, medical problems can get even worse because of the conditions within prison, including violence and poor health care.
Their physiological age is actually 10 to 15 years older than you know, what their age actually is.
Peterson says that all has financial consequences.
The best estimates are that it's anywhere from 2 to 5 times more to take care of someone who's older than it is to take care of someone who's younger in prison.
At the same time, studies show the chance of people reoffending decreases with age. Every state except for Iowa has what's known as compassionate release policies. Those allow inmates to get out early because of advanced age or serious health problems. But Wessler, the Prison Policy Initiative spokesman, says compassionate release is rarely used.
It's a cumbersome process. It requires lots of approvals, lots of documentation.
Last year, Wisconsin granted compassionate release to 5 prisoners. Many inmates in the state are not eligible for the program, including people convicted of serious felonies and anyone who committed a crime before the year 2000. Wessler hopes for a more far-reaching solution.
My hope is that before prisons consider opening a nursing home behind bars, states will look at revisiting some of these harsh sentencing laws.
He and other advocates say the focus should be on reducing the incarcerated population to begin with. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news here on Central Time, some science, some sight. What is color? How do our brains perceive it? A neuroscientist joins the show who's been researching color, what it means, how our brains react to it, and more. And we want to hear from you. Is there a thing out there? I have one of these. I'll probably tell you about it. Is there a thing out there where you see something as one color and somebody else in your life, a spouse maybe, sees it as another color? Do you have points of confusion or argument over what color something is? If you have some form of color blindness, love to hear from you, but not just from you. You can get our conversation started right now. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know if you have a color that is a point of conflict in your life. Email ideas@WPR.org. Then join that conversation with a neuroscientist coming up after the news. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, schools have been experimenting with all kinds of learning technologies for years, computers in the classroom, tablets, and more. Check out the state of the art as a new school year kicks off. Maybe let us know your experience as a kid, a teacher, a parent with technology in the classroom. Then join that conversation tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. What is the most divisive food at your dinner table? The one that you love and someone else in your family hates, or vice versa? We talked about our food pickiness a couple weeks back on Food Friday with Deb Perlman. Now here's a new survey that asked Americans about the most polarizing foods on the table. The Harris Poll did the survey commissioned by Instacart. Here are the foods that most people say they hate. Anchovies topped the list. Half of the people surveyed said, nope, I got nothing against them. I don't love them. Going down the list from there, black licorice, meh. Oysters, I don't get it. Beets, I love. Most of the people I know hate them. Blue cheese, yeah, I love blue cheese. Okra, couldn't have picked it out of a lineup when I was a kid. Can't get enough of it now. Capers, I like them. Brussels sprouts, they got better over the years. Fennel, eh, you can keep the fennel. Here is your challenge. Create a single dish using all of those ingredients. Food news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The way we look at the world is often shaped by the colors we see. Color can convey an emotion, like red for anger or for love. It can tell us a temperature, like a cold blue. It can symbolize an idea, like green for nature. Sometimes our eyes can deceive us, and 2 people might look at the same object and see 2 different colors. There was that famous dress that went viral back in 2015 that people saw as either blue and black or white and gold. There's the less famous pair of shoes that I saw as gray, but everybody else in the whole world saw as brown. Many paintings or other artworks can create optical illusions with color that make you perceive the same color differently just based on what else is around it. Our next guest has spent years researching the way our eyes and our brains perceive colors to understand how it works and how it shapes the way we see reality. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you ever disagree with friends or family members about what color something is? Do you have questions about how we see colors, where we might get things wrong, how it all works in our minds? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Bevel Conway is a neuroscientist, artist, and senior investigator in the Perception, Cognition, and Action section of the National Eye Institute within the National Institutes of Health. Bevel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Rob.
You've devoted a lot of your work to studying color. What led you down that path?
I started as a kid, you know, when my mother's sister gave me my first set of real watercolors, you know, the kinds in tubes, when I was probably seven. And I just remember squeezing out these saturated pigments and watching the puddles just bleed into each other. And it was like, you know, better than movies. I got to create it. It was like I was the director of my own little movie. And I just was like, this is so cool.
Now, what actually is color? When young Bevel was looking at that paint color, what was happening?
Yeah, the question of what is color is perhaps the oldest question in psychology. It goes way back to the ancient Greeks. And, you know, what's really interesting is that there was this shift when we developed technology like cameras that made us think that we could take color out of the world. You could make a black and white picture. And, you know, before we had that technology, vision was color. That's all there was. It was, you open your eyes, you look around, the stuff you see around you is just color. It's like there. And so, you know, there's been this kind of interesting experiment that technology has done to us to make us think that color is somehow something we can pull out of the world, but it's really not. You know, your question is, what is color? It's lots of different things. And the way I like to think about it is it's really the interaction, the two sides of a coin between the stuff in the world and your mind. And it's kind of where those two things meet, make this thing we call color.
And different cultures, and I remember this back in school, different cultures might have more or fewer words for color, different ways of divvying up the spectrum. What do we see? How much variety is there out there in what cultures call colors?
There is a terrific variety in what different cultures call colors, the way they carve up what we think of as a color space. Some languages, they may only have two or three terms that everybody in the community knows that they can use to communicate colors. And other cultures, like, you know, English is one of them, we have probably 15, 20 terms that everybody in the society and the culture knows. You know, one of the old questions is whether or not that means that the cultures that only have two or three color terms, do they not see those colors? And that is absolutely wrong. They definitely see those colors. They see all the colors that we see with our fancy color naming system. They just, you know, for one reason or another, they haven't sort of settled on needing to communicate what they see to each other.
What is going on in our brains when we get that visual input? What's going on to say, yeah, that's red, but that's blue, Rob?
Oh, my God. That is the million-dollar question. So, you know, when you walk around, people have probably heard of rods and cones, the two types of photoreceptor cells in your eye. You can think of these as, you know, little eggs in an egg carton, a big cup egg carton, all facing the incoming light, you know, ready to catch it like a catcher in a baseball game. They're all sitting there waiting for their photon to arrive. And when, you know, in normal daylight, we only use the cones. So the rods are completely quiet or almost completely quiet. And so that means that the cone types that you have, the three cones you have in your eye, they are supporting everything you think of as vision during daylight. So they give you black and white vision and color vision and motion and faces and where you are in the world and everything you think of as vision. And those three cone types happen to be tuned to different parts of the rainbow. So you've got one that's tuned more towards shorter wavelengths, and then you've got two that are squished very close in, you know, their peak sensitivity is right in what we call yellow in the rainbow. And somehow your visual system sort of listens to these three cone types in the eye and says, okay, you know, I'm going to compare this one and this one and this one and this one, and I'm going to, you know, interpret those signals to be red or to interpret those signals to be blue. but there's a heck of a lot more that's going on than just a kind of straightforward code listening to those three cone types in the retina. There's all the stuff about what you expect to see, what you've seen before, whether or not, you know, that patch of light is next to another patch of light. You know, when you probably when you were an elementary school kid, and if you aren't still like me painting, you know, you remember putting a colored mark on the page. And then, you know, someone comes along and says, OK, now you filled in your apple with that color. Now paint the background. And you go and paint the background. And all of a sudden, the color you thought was perfectly good in the apple is now a different color. And you're like, ah, why did they do that? And that's because color isn't just related to the light coming to your eye from one little patch in the scene in the painting. What you ascribe to that patch in the painting is actually a kind of unconscious summing together of everything that you're seeing right now and everything you've seen before.
We're talking about the science of color with neuroscientist Bevel Conway. You can join in with your questions, your experiences with perceiving, maybe misperceiving color at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Shelly is with us in Blanchardville. Shelly, hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I was just going to comment that every time we put paint on a wall, my husband and I definitely argue about what color it is and whether or not we need to run back to Menards to get a different version.
Yeah, who's right when you argue about this, Shelley?
Never him.
Thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate that. So what is the deal there? And I think a lot of people have had that experience where we disagree over what color something is. What's going on, Bevel?
Yeah, and you know, there are a couple of different factors going on there. So one of them is, you know, when you go and you buy that, you get that paint sample from the wall and you put it on the wall, you know, are you painting the whole wall with that color before you decide what color it is? A lot of people, you know, get a little sample, they put it on the wall and they think, yeah, that looks good. And then they paint the whole wall and all of a sudden it doesn't look as yellow as you thought it was going to. So there can be some of this sort of, how good are you at picturing in your mind's eye what colors things will turn out? But, you know, one of the most interesting features of color is the gender asymmetry. So, you know, speaking in general terms, this certainly isn't true of all men and all women, but women tend to have more color terms than men, and they tend to kind of care more about it. They talk more about color terms or use color terms more often in language. It's almost like they're a little bit more attentive. And I'm in a same-sex family. I have a male spouse, you know, so we're sort of stuck just with the two of us trying to figure out what to do with our children and how to relate to them and make sure they get enough color terms. But one of the things that one of the experiments we ran a number of years ago was we asked people what colors things looked like when they sat inside a room that was illuminated with low pressure sodium light. I don't know if you're familiar with this light. It's that kind of eerie yellow light that they used to have in parking garages.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's weird about that light is that your retina can't encode any color information. You're actually completely colorblind. And most people sort of don't notice right away. They're like, something's weird. I don't know exactly what's going on. And when we tested men and women in this environment, the women were much more likely to be like, there's something fishy. No, I can't see color properly. And your face, wow, that looks really green and weird. And the men were like, you know, they'd mark down on a little display what they were seeing. And exactly what they were seeing looked just like what the women were seeing. They just were not particularly inclined to tell us about it.
We are talking to National Eye Institute neuroscientist Bevel Conway about how we see colors, the way our color perception shapes our reality. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think a lot about the role of colors in your day-to-day life, maybe your line of work? If you're colorblind, I'd love to hear from you about how that affects your life. Join in with your experiences or questions about color at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Bevel Conway, neuroscientist, artist, and senior investigator at the National Institutes of Health. He's with us today to share his research into how we see color and the ways our color perception can affect our everyday lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Got an email from Emmanuel in Strawberry Point, Iowa. Emmanuel writes, "When I go from a bright room into a dimly lit room, I see what's there fine, but with a slightly different overlay of small red dots with yellow circles around them and green circles around those. Are these my cones continuing to fire at full blast?" He says, "I don't have diabetes or any visual abnormality. Is that a thing, Bevan?"
Well, that is very interesting. It's definitely not your single cones. They would fire with two, you know, that if you activate a single cone at a time, the dot of light that you would see is so small that most people wouldn't notice it. There is a technique now that's being used to try and do that. And I actually had my retina stimulated with single photons of light not too long ago, just to see what it's like. My guess is that it's probably related to the blood vessels that carry red blood cells in the blood vessels in front of the eye. And there's they're refracting a little bit of light, and that may be what you're seeing. But it's an interesting observation.
Thanks for that note. Let's go back to our callers now. Sam is with us in Shatek. Sam, hi.
Going back to the lady that said she and her husband can't agree on colors.
Oh, we lost Sam. We got a note. He told our producer that the True Value Hardware there won't allow men to buy paint unless he's got a signed certificate from his wife. Okay. Sorry we lost you, Sam. That actually reminds me of a follow-up, Bevel. You mentioned that, you know, at least in American culture, women have more words for color, more interest in it. Do we know, is this something biologically brain-based? Is this a social thing? Women are brought up to be more interested in these colors. Do we have a why behind that?
It's probably a social thing. In fact, it's almost certainly a social thing. One of the big questions in our business is, why do we have color? And some of your listeners might be like confused. Why is there a color expert at the National Institutes of Health? That seems weird. and the answer is that color is one of the first things that first aid responders will notice when they look at someone. You know, they're called to attend to someone who's in duress, and one of the first things they'll look at is the color of their skin, because it tells you a lot about someone's health status. When our children were brand newly born, they were tiny little preemies, and they spent 2 months in the NICU, and the nurse, the senior nurse, came by on the first day and said, you know, I know a lot of new parents just are itching to put some clothes on their babies, but we can't do that because we need to see the color of their skin in order to know how healthy these children are. And, you know, if they take a nosedive health-wise, we'll see it right away in the skin, which we won't see necessarily or hear in the monitors. And so, you know, you can build up a kind of cultural story that in America, historically, traditionally, you know, women have been more assigned to a kind of caregiving role. And so maybe they're sort of through cultural acclimatization and so on, more likely to care about color in that way. But certainly, you know, men are perfectly capable of having the same level of color as women. There is one way in which it's biologically determined that men can have sort of worse color vision. And that's that, you know, red-green color blindness is genetic and is carried on the X chromosome. And since men only have one X chromosome, if they've got a screw up on that X chromosome, it shows up as red-green color blindness. So red-green color blindness is much more common in men than it is in women. But the sort of disagreements that, you know, husbands and wives are having at the paint shop, those are very unlikely to have to do with, you know, genetic color blindness.
Let's go to Carol now in De Pere. Carol, hi.
Hi. I have a question about light perception. I've only had light perception for several years now, lost all detail in color vision, but I see yellow, like today the sun is out, I guess. So I see everywhere yellow. And if it's a cloudier day, it might be a grayish yellow. Is that just the visual cortex of the brain rather than anything with the retina?
What's the nature of your sort of health history? Have you lost most of your vision? Is this acquired? This is a new thing?
It's not new. I was low vision my whole life. I was a preemie with an oxygen problem. But I had vision enough to get through college and work. But now it's down to just light perception. And, I do everything by audio now.
Interesting. Uh-huh. Carol, thanks for sharing that experience. Bevel, is this something you've encountered before?
So it could be a number of different things. And obviously, I'm not examining a patient right now. So I would caution against taking too seriously whatever I say. But, as we age, one of the things that happens to your lens, that's the focusing part of the focusing apparatus inside your eye, is that it yellows. And it could be possible, most people adapt to the yellowing of their lens with age, but it could be possible that is something that's contributing to her experience.
Thanks a lot for sharing that experience, Carol, at 800-642-1234. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I've always wanted to say this. There's something dysfunctional when I see someone adding blue food coloring to a mini golf course waterfall or a casino pool or something. They don't need to add blue, but they want to add blue because they want people to perceive it as, like a pristine blue pool of water. Mm-hmm. Water is clear.
Jeff, I worked at my uncle's swimming pool store back in the day. Yeah, there is a bluer, I can't remember what they call it, but a bluening product that you can add to water. We really want to perceive water as blue, Bevel, even though it's transparent, I guess.
I love the observation. I know in Chicago, I was there one year where they had their St. Patrick's Day parade, and they filled the river there with green, or the canal, with green paint. And it was the most disconcerting visual experience. The blueness of water is interesting. The reason people like or think of water as being blue is obviously it's usually reflecting a blue sky, because the water functions as a very strong reflector. And so we have a kind of deeply ingrained association of blue and water. And I think that's probably where that impulse comes to try and fill it with blue coloring. But trying to match the color of the water to the color of the sky is a challenge, because, of course, the sky is constantly changing its color as the clouds go by. So I think what people don't anticipate is that when you look at the water, what you're really doing is stitching together the color that you're seeing in the water with the color of the sky in that instant. And that's what you're sort of after, is that kind of cohesion of a visual experience.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Okay, Bevel, here's something I had to bring up, because whenever I mentioned to people the topic of this conversation today, they talked about a time in their life, sometimes as a little kid or maybe as a college student or whatever, where they wondered, do I see the color, say, red, the same way other people do? And like, it's a mind-wrecking philosophical quandary for them that I'm guessing you get asked about all the time, probably. What do you say to people when they bring that up?
Yeah, it's one of the oldest questions. It was raised first by John Locke, who is a philosopher, British empiricist philosopher, who asked, when I look at a marigold flower, is it the same as you looking at a violet, one of those violet colors? And the answer is, we can't really know for sure, but we do have some pretty darn good clues. The first is, if really you experience color very differently from me, then we wouldn't have a conceptual framework that would allow us to have a meaningful conversation. And in the old days, it used to be thought that it's conceivable you could see a different color because maybe the tuning properties in your retina might be different. But now we know what the tuning properties are, and we know that they're consistent from person to person. So there's a pretty darn good chance that when you see red, I'm seeing the same thing. We do have some brain imaging data where we compare from one person to the next and show that there's a similar pattern of response in the two people. But, the question is a hard one. And the reason it's a hard one is that we were astounded to discover that there is more brain, cerebral cortex, the thinking part of your brain, involved in color perception. There's as much involved in color perception as there is involved in face recognition. So you have a lot of brain doing color, and it tells us that color is something really deep and fundamental to the human experience. So I'd find it hard to imagine that, you know, evolution would go to all the trouble to make all of that brain and have it spit out some random piece of noise that didn't mean anything to you and me.
It's a good place to leave it. Bevel, thanks a lot for sharing your research with us.
My pleasure. This has been fun.
That's Bevel Conway, a neuroscientist, artist, and senior investigator in the Perception, Cognition, and Action section of the National Eye Institute within the National Institutes of Health. He joined us today to talk about how we see colors and what colors tell us about the world around us. If you're wondering what art created by a neuroscientist who studies color looks like, you can follow his work at bevelconway.com. Let's get a link to that up on the program note. You can find that at wpr.org/centraltime. Cool 3D stuff. If you have a funny story to share about a disagreement over color, you can still share that. Email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, kids are heading back to school and cafeterias are getting ready for school lunch. Look behind the scenes at school lunch programs, how they work, and the policies and the politics behind them. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about why country music has been at the center of politics recently, including on the Republican primary debate stage. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.